This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Where do you stand on puns? I took a stand on puns, but they made me give it back.
Oh!
Have you heard puns with any frequency on the radio? Maybe you think puns are too lowbrow for NPR. Well, I'm here to tell you they NP aren't. like them or not, puns are a part, she loves it, of English rhetoric, and their origins can be traced back hundreds, even thousands of years. Today, the wittiest among us sometimes exchange jabs, plays of words, or a turn of a phrase. And that battle of wits is now a competition in the triangle.
And our final category for the evening is the high school experience.
I look around, and this is a damn handsome room.
That was so sophomoric of you to say.
Oh, go to Bell.
Don't get so testy with me. Are you getting freshman?
Oh, my goodness. That is from last year's Great Pun Championship in Durham. The final voice was the reigning pun master of Durham, Colin Butler, who is here with me in the studio. Colin, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun to be here.
It's great to be here, and we're inviting our listeners to call in and to talk, you know, to share puns with us. Mm-hmm. But the reason we had you here, Colin, is because without you, it couldn't be a Colin show. That's great stuff. All right, Showdown continues its fourth straight night, Monday at Motorco, 7 o'clock, along with me to talk about that competition. English rhetoric is George Gopin. He's the judge of the contest and a professor emeritus in the practice of rhetoric at Duke University. Hello, George.
Good to be here, Frank. Thank you.
George, do you really like puns, or are you just Gopin' with them?
You know, it's wonderful to have a name like Gopin in this contest, because when I start each of the individual contests, the 23 of them for the 24 contestants, I give them the instruction, go pun.
Oh, that's so fabulous. Listen, we want to hear from you. 877-962-9862. You can just like be on the line with us and just fire a pun. So tell us, George, how does the contest work?
It's an imitation of the National Pun Contest held in Austin, Texas every year. We have a number of contestants. It's sometimes 24, sometimes 32, and they're arranged in a tennis tournament kind of fashion of single elimination bouts. The first two contestants get up. I will give them a category that I have laboriously made up, and they have 12 seconds. The first person has 12 seconds to produce a viable pun. If I judge it to be so, then it's the other person's turn. And they keep going until somebody in a 12-second period fails to do so. If they both succeed 10 times in a row, we call the match at that point, and we have a time taker who has measured the time, number of seconds of responses for both of them, and the smallest conglomerate time for the 10 answers wins. And if it's within 5 seconds, then we give it to the audience to vote one of them off the island.
Hmm. Single elimination. So I have to be married to play? Come on. It's going to keep coming. It's going to keep coming, George. We're not going to stop.
May divorce be with you.
Hey, I'll bracket up. It's a good tournament structure.
See, I love this stuff, and I do really love it. George, tell us about this. You know, as a professor of rhetoric, I mean, people say puns are the lowest form of humor. Nonsense, right?
Total nonsense. I think it's actually mean-spiritedness and low-mindedness. A pun requires that you recognize its wit when it's given to you, and that you do it as quickly as possible. And people who do not want to be tested like that in public are annoyed when anybody tries to make any play on words whatsoever.
Well done. Colin, you were a runner-up in the competition. Do you have experience with this? I mean, do you kind of practice? What do you do to get ready for a pun contest?
Well, I infuriate everyone I know generally leading up to it. But I sort of drill myself and so on the days leading up to it, just kind of, you know, test myself in the same format. But what I actually, the most important thing really I find is just to try and be in a good mood going in, because something I actually learned, I dabbled in improv. And one thing we learned from that was that you're on stage playing a game, and you don't play games to entertain other people. You play games to entertain yourself. And to be on that stage. It's actually you should be having fun. And if you're having fun, psychologically, you actually are better at thinking up lateral connections and things like that. So you're more open-minded. It's fun.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that because it is about having an open mind and making these connections, I think, is part of what a pun is all about, right, George? I mean, first of all, it shows both the weakness and the strength of language. They're resilient. They're powerful because they kind of work in many directions. Words can take us in many directions at once, right?
Well, I took a course in comedy when I was an undergraduate, and along the way we studied Henri Bergson's take on it, the French philosopher, and he said when you juxtapose two things which are incongruous, you get comedies. So you take a short fat guy and you take a tall thin guy. Neither one's funny by themselves, but you put them together and you got 15% of the great comedy teams of all times: Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy. It's something funny just by it being different. And a pun is taking a word and putting it in a different place.
Yeah, I think some of the greatest humor that's ever been written comes incongruous. But so here's the thing. Not only that, and I think juxtaposition is one thing. It does sort of reveal some of the cracks in the logic of language. But, I mean, in a way, isn't that what poetry is? It's a play on words. It's a word that can mean one thing and another, and it has a valence in this direction, or it has a sound that might remind you of a word that pulls you in a different direction. I mean, poetry is a corollary to punning, isn't it?
The difference between the two is with poetry, you expect to be subjected to that experience when you read it, and you seek it out if you like it. With puns, they come in public, and you are subjected to it whether you like it or not. There are different kinds of juxtapositioning, though. One of the categories a couple of years ago in the contest was eggs. And you could take just that sound, eggs, and do something with it. So you want a fine breakfast? Well, I know one that would be excellent.
Okay, that's so unexpected.
Or you could take something that's connected to it that is a sound. You want a good breakfast? Eggs are a sure thing. Now, that requires somebody to know about the New England habit of shirred eggs, which the rest of the country doesn't know. So it becomes already elitist. Do you know the word or not? And then it can be just an intellectual connection that doesn't have to do anything to do with the sound itself. A good breakfast, a hard-boiled egg is hard to beat.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. And the thing about it is spontaneous and dynamic, so you can't really poach a joke like that, can you? I mean... Colin, tell us a little bit about
that. That was over too easy.
My brain is fried. It's really time to go. But I guess we're all kind of baking in the joy of this.
I can scramble to get it all together.
Have you been doing this all your life? I mean, have you been a punster? And people sort of say, here comes Colin?
It comes and goes sometimes. I have my moments, and there are times that people just have to shut me down. But I've always been one of those people that values puns more than anything. I'm going to tell the story of my favorite pun I've ever told, because it's something that sticks with me and will stick with me for the rest of my life, which is usually not how the high regard people hold puns in. But I had the opportunity once when I was doing improv. We were talking in a group about doing a little skit on a stage, and people were talking about, wait, what if we got a bear suit? I know that our friend Juan has a bear suit, and we might be able to borrow it. And somebody said, yeah, but is it going to fit any of us? And at that point, I heard Choirs of Angels, and some of you playing at home might see where this is going. I said, guys, Juan size fits all. And the fact that I will take that to my grave as a point of pride, I think, speaks to me.
So puns have a future. George, tell us about their past. Where do you put puns in history? And English is such a delightful language because it is so robust and has so many influences.
English is wonderful because it has so many different progenitors. I mean, half of us comes from the Germanic and half of us comes from the Romance, from the Old French. And the French and the Germans have never gotten along well anyway, so when you put them into one language. You've got all sorts of discordance. The Greek's word for it was paranomasia, which is any kind of playing on words. All three of the different egg puns, or all seven of the different egg puns, would all be paranomasia. Maybe two of them, people would argue, aren't puns. Recognizing that language can be played with is how language was built in the Western world. Latin would take a root of a word and then would put a different prefix and different suffix endings to change what it could mean and where it would be in the experience of life. And to use a Latin word was to engage in wordplay. It was natural to it.
Well, and you, I should point out in the interest of fairness and balance, you talked about a progenitor. We will have a congenitor on next week to balance what you said.
Well, and play it again, you'll have a regenitor.
It's good stuff. Have you established that it does it take a certain amount of wit? I mean, what again? Shakespeare was brilliant at this. His often plays don't hang on the puns, but they there are a lot of pivotal moments that, you know, where these puns take us in a couple of directions at once.
Shakespeare made up more language than any other human being we know of. You look at a bestseller on the Times best-selling list. How many words go into that, not how many words, count them up, how many different words, anywhere from 4,000 to 7,000 words gives you a big enough vocabulary to be on bestseller list. Shakespeare had a vocabulary of 25,000 words, and he made up probably a third of them. Now, many of them by making a noun into a verb. He talks about King Richard II monarchizing. He made up that word by adding a verbal ending. But his mind was playing with the words at all time, and that's why Hamlet is still played today. It's just filled with plays on words. Every time he opens his mouth, he is twisting what somebody else did. Shakespeare's favorite comic technique is to take the last line that the person you're talking to has said and grab a word out of it and twist it around so it doesn't mean that anymore, but you have conquered them by using their word against them. You can find it hundreds of times in Shakespeare comedies.
And elisions, I think, are some of my favorites. I mean, I use the one in this billboard, but these are some of my favorites where you'll say some people love puns, others just endure them. And so when you kind of put a few words together, I think he does this with – I can't remember which play it is, but there's a suggestion that the king has a concubine and there's a battle scene. Must be in one of the historical plays. And someone yells, "It's the king's trumpet." Or is it the king's strumpet? And so these elisions, and that's just embedded in the play. It's ingenious because, again, he's trying to evoke both of these, the conquering king and the unfaithful king.
And they undo that, too. In the 18th century, when Baudelaireization came around, when we started expurgating, taking the dirty stuff out of Shakespeare, one of the words they had to deal with was strumpet. And they didn't want – they wouldn't put in prostitute. It would be just as bad as strumpet. So they took off the first S and made it a trumpet so that the knowing people would understand it and the people who didn't wouldn't be offended. And it produced in Cymbeline this great line, "Thy mistress, Pisanio, hath played the trumpet in my bed."
There are so many wonderful puns in prostitute and trumpet, but yet I'm going to let them pass in the name of good taste. So what do we do? George, you have a story actually about a battle of wits from your own undergraduate years, right? A competition.
I do indeed, yes. My freshman year roommate, one of the most brilliant minds I've ever encountered, a man named Peter Gould, still alive and well in Vermont. He and I just naturally started exactly this kind of internal pun contest. Somebody would make a pun and then the other person had immediately come up with one in the same area. And one day, my greatest pun, he said, "Well, you know, I don't relish that." So condiments were on the board. I said, "Well, I can't catch up with that." And we went back and forth. And then the only time I ever really beat him, we were talking about him maltreating his girlfriend. I said, "You keep doing that and she will write you a Dijon letter saying poop on you."
Oh, man, you were on a roll.
Two mustards in one sentence. You can't.
Absolutely. Hey, let's do this. Can we do this? Can you give us a category and we'll kind of, Colin and I will play a little bit?
All right, good. Let's take gardens.
On a roll, I said. I don't know.
Gardens and gardening.
gardens
that grow.
And gardening. Wow, that arose out of nowhere. How could I? And as a man with only two lips, you can imagine how difficult it is for me.
You say that with such a flowery.
Hey, leave me alone, will you? I'm doing the best I can.
This all stems from some deeper issue, I think, doesn't it?
Well, I think the deep humus in all of this joking around is what keeps us together.
Well, I think, if you just keep coming up with the puns, you can just flow them one into the other.
And gardening, I mean, there's fertile territory there for punning for kind of infinity.
Oh, man, I could just leave you alone. You could go soilo on this one.
Personally, I think this is just a bunch of manure.
It's all gone to pot by now, I think.
Oh, it certainly has. Well, it certainly is. We could seed the whole audience and see if we can bring some of them into all of this.
Well, Monday night, you know, puns will be great, and they will be in Durham.
Ooh. I think, and as you go on, I mean, obviously it gets harder and harder, and that's the harvest of all when you kind of think about it. I just want to remind everybody that we are talking about the great Durham Pun Championship today on The State of Things. Colin Butler is the 2014 Pun Master of Durham. George Gopin is Professor Emeritus in the Practice of Rhetoric at Duke University. But let's talk about, for a minute, about rhetoric. Are people interested in it anymore? Is it a topic that we should certainly be interested in?
We are incredibly interested in it. Every single business in the world and politics is interested in it. They just don't know to call it that. Rhetoric has a negative term cast to it, the mere rhetoric, empty rhetoric. But rhetoric is how language goes about meaning. But if you can control it, you're in control.
You think that – is it still true, or have we become so visual that now people who can manipulate visual images are in a better place than, say, Cicero was as the master of rhetoric in
Rome? We almost got to be a post-literate society about 25 years ago when telephone calls and flying off to see someone was the way business was done. And then email got invented and Twitter and everything else, and suddenly became a hyper-literate society. Yeah. Everybody writes now much more than they ever used to. It may be shorter and it may not have capital letters or punctuation, but people are using the written word to communicate much more now than 100 years ago.
But the spoken word, I mean, as a person who has been, you know, covering politicians for 300 or 400 years now in my career, I can't tell if it's creeping codgerism or if I'm really hearing a drop off. I mean, for instance, we just had a member of the North Carolina legislature who couldn't actually quote Jefferson. He was scrambling to find the quote and then came up with some really weak, kind of vague version. There was a time when every member of Congress could quote and would, with rhetorical flourish. And I mean, I'm not sure if that was better or worse necessarily, but they can't do it anymore.
I'll give you my personal reason for why this has happened. It is the decline and the presence in our culture of classical music. Hmm. We don't teach it anymore. It went out of the school systems 20, 25 years ago. We couldn't afford it. Kids today have no idea about what classical music is or who they were or what it sounds like. You don't find it in movies. You find it all the time in movies in the 30s and 40s. Without classical music, we have lost that sense of something going somewhere linearly in search of a place to resolve. Hmm. And without having that sense of motion, the prose has lost that, too, and that means memory is harder.
That is a sound explanation. That's fascinating. And what about the – so the flow and in the logic of music, which we come to think of as a kind of nonverbal logic, but you're saying to some extent the struggling, the grappling with that, particularly as these themes and variations try to resolve in the last movement – you're saying that people track that, they don't anymore, and we're not listening the way we used to.
I think that's right. I think words and notes actually go about meaning in the same way. You take a concert, take a string quartet, since I like chamber music, stop them in the middle of the second movement, the first beat of the 21st measure, the four people have just played a chord, freeze it. Every person in that room listening has a unique set of expectations about what's going to happen in the next moment. Unfreeze the next moment. The next moment played, the meaning of it, is the sum total of the way in which your set of expectations was fulfilled and or violated.
Fascinating.
Same thing is true with words.
We've come to the end. This is your final chance. We're at the end of the segment, and it's time to say goodbye.
I would like to apologize on behalf of Youthful Society for the violence we've done against the institution.
That is Colin Butler. He is a defending pun master of Durham. Thank you for being on the show. George Gopin, Professor Emeritus in the Practice of Rhetoric at Duke University and the judge of the 4th Annual Great Pun Championship Competition Monday at Motorco in Durham, 7 o'clock. George, thank you so much.
Delight to be here. Thank you for having me, Frank.
Coming up, one of the brightest lights in jazz, Jenny Scheinman, on The State of Things. Stay tuned. Now he's sleeping.